right in this wind. On my good horse I call you, my shiny black bears, to the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding,
you're listening to episode 512 of Unwelcome Guests. I'm Robin Upton. Last week we had a pair of classic anti-war films from Gwyn Dyer. This week our first hour is a much more recent one of his, with a lot of up-to-date facts about climate change and military scenario planning for climate wars or resource wars. And yet I think we need a contrast, because he's so firmly entrenched within the confrontational paradigm. So in the next hour, I'm going to be presenting a gem from the Unwelcome Guests archive by late great American ecologist Murray Bookchin, making the point that unless we can reconceive ourselves not as dominators of nature, but in harmony with it, then we have a very bleak future ahead. Martin Luther King talked about non-violence or non-existence as the real human choice, and the more I learn of climate change, the more I become convinced of this reality.
About 2 years ago, I realized that the military forces, the general staffs of the world, were starting to take a very close interest in the fallout from climate change in terms of political problems, strategic issues, climate refugees washing up against borders and didn't want to let them in, failed states because governments couldn't feed their people, even regional wars, mostly over water, you know, between upstream and downstream states when there's not enough water to go around. The Pentagon, interestingly, was doing the most work, and this is pretty impressive given that they were working for George Bush at the time, and he didn't like it even mentioned that there was a phenomenon called climate change, and yet they're doing these studies in-house inside the Pentagon on what their jobs would be in a warming world. Just, you know, 1 degree, 2 degrees Celsius warmer than the present. Nothing runaway, but even so, they were seeing lots of opportunities, and of course they're always looking for work. But I think that doesn't mean they're wrong, you see. So I started pursuing this thing for about a year and a half. I basically put that on my agenda, and wherever I went, I would go and interview whoever locally was worth talking to, whether they be generals or climate scientists or even the negotiators who are working on the post-Kyoto Accord, or politicians in a few cases. Must have talked to 80, 90 people, formal interviews, you know, in a dozen countries. And at the end of the process, I actually knew a number of things I hadn't even suspected at the start, some of which aren't in the public domain even now. So really what I'm going to do this evening is offer you four conclusions that I arrived at as a result of this trek round the houses. And the first is this: the scientists are really scared. Conversations I had with the scientists generally had an undercurrent of panic running beneath them, because their perception is that the changes are happening faster than their models predicted. They're often attacked for being too extreme in their models, but no, they're quite the contrary. Their models do not adequately describe the current reality in terms of the speed of change. And this has both unsettled them in the sense that, you know, they don't like to be wrong, but also frightened them because it means that we have much less time than we thought. The way governments assess the need to do something about greenhouse gas emissions, carbon dioxide, and the rest, is essentially to start from the numbers that we get from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which, of course, they pay for. It meets every 4 or 5 years. A couple of thousand leading climate scientists from all the relevant disciplines, oceanographers, meteorologists, atmospheric chemists, sit in committees, review all the research for the last, well, since the last time they met, 4 or 5 years ago, and attempt to come up with up-to-date predictions of how big this problem is and how fast it's coming at us. These scientists are selected by their, nominated by their peers, actually selected by the governments, and the governments also get to vet their conclusions at the end. There's a little bit of an arm wrestle every time because governments don't want panicky statements of what's going to happen. And the last report published by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, came out only last year, 2007, and it gave us a list of quite worrisome predictions about what would be happening by the end of the century, a range of possible futures in terms of global warming from 2 degrees Celsius, hotter average global temperature at the bottom, to 6.5 degrees average global temperature higher at the top end of the range of estimates, which is one hell of a range, you have to admit. I mean, 2 degrees, I can see us adapting to that. You got 92 years to do it, and you might even get on top of the problem and reduce your emissions and not get to 2 degrees. 6.5 means it's moving real fast, and 6.5 you don't adapt to. At 6.5, you're into mass dieback of the human and most other large animal populations because most of the world has turned into desert, and a lot of that is being inundated as the sea level comes up. So there's a large range there, and there's reasons. I mean, that basically there's 2 reasons the range is so wide. One is they can't predict how fast economies are going to grow and emissions are going to grow. You know, will China grow at 11%, 10% a year economically for the next 30 years like it did for the last 20? Or will it do a Japan and after a couple of decades of high-speed growth, it slows down to everybody else's pace? Big difference. The other uncertainty is actually more scientific. It isn't absolutely certain how the climate will react to the next bunch of excess carbon dioxide we dump on top of the natural cycle, because it's not what, well, they call, it's not a linear process. It's a non-linear process. If you start from a different temperature, what happens when you put more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere varies. An example. From the height of the last major glaciation, say 20,000 years ago, you know what, kilometer and a half of ice above where we're sitting now, that was a time when the average carbon dioxide concentration in the air was about 180 parts per million. The glaciers thaw, the glaciation ends, we enter the long interglacial, the endless summer of the present, in which the human race grew from 10 million to 6.5 billion. We built this civilization. By 10,000 years ago, it's 5 degrees warmer and about 100 parts per million extra. It's up to 280 parts per million. So there's a nice, easy relationship. 5 degrees, an extra 100 parts per million. Got it. No. We've actually, in the last century and a half, added another 100 parts per million. Since the advent of large-scale industrialization in only a few countries, but it accumulates. Carbon dioxide stays in the air a long time, about 200 years on average, and yet it isn't another 5 degrees hotter. On the contrary, it's only about 0.3 of a degree hotter so far. Probably a good deal more than that in the end, because there's a delayed action phenomenon with carbon dioxide. You don't get the full impact of its presence in the atmosphere right away. Some of it straggles in over 30, 25, or 50 years. And also, we've only been doing it in a really big scale since the Second World War. 3/4 of that extra 100 parts per million is since the Second World War. So, uncertainties about the economy, uncertainties about the sensitivity of the atmosphere to extra carbon dioxide, and, therefore, a wide range of estimates. But here's the problem. The actual observed changes in the last 3 or 4 years are so rapid that they're putting us above the top prediction. above the 6.4 by the end of the century. The headline change is what's happening to the Arctic sea ice. We don't have figures for the Arctic sea ice coverage going back before satellites, so let's say the 1970s, 60s or 70s. But since then, consistently, what has happened in the Arctic has been that it virtually is all frozen over in the wintertime, 10 million square kilometers, and by the end of the summer melt season, late September, it's down to about 7 million square kilometers, and then it refreezes as the winter progresses. And anecdotal evidence from explorers suggests that was the case long before that as well. Suddenly, in 2005, it melted back from the average from 10 million, not to 7, but to 5 million square kilometers. We lost 2 million in a year. 2006, same phenomenon. 2007, we were down to almost 4 million square kilometers. Half, or little more than half, of what should be there at that time. And this year, the September just passed, 4.3 million square kilometers. So this is moving much faster than they expected. The IPCC, Intergovernmental Panel, report of 2007 suggested we might see an ice-free Arctic Ocean by 2040s if we're unlucky, 2060s if we're lucky. Now they're saying it could be as early as 2013, 5 years from now. That's that acceleration, and they are seeing it in other less dramatic changes as well, the changes in rainfall pattern, the jet stream circulation, so on. So they're scared. And the numbers that governments are working with, based on those IPCC predictions, are much too conservative in how fast they propose to get the emissions down. For example, the Americans are finally coming round. 85% of Americans now believe that climate change is a real problem. Not ready to do much about it yet, but at least we're halfway there. Both presidential candidates in the elections just passed promised 80% emissions cuts in the United States by 2050. And if you believe the IPCC numbers, that's probably okay. That would do the trick, provided you front-end loaded and get a lot of the emission cuts soon. But if the kinds of numbers that we're now seeing from recent observations are true, you need to be down to 80% cuts by 2030, which is only 22 years away, in fact, 21 years away, which is a rather tall order, but that's what the scientists think now is the likely answer. They're a bit embarrassed about this, to be truthful. I mean, they've been going up against this wall of well-paid denial for years, and they finally got our attention. And now they have to come back and say, sorry, could we have those numbers back? These are the real numbers. It's much worse. You know, from a purely human point of view, this is not a really fun thing to do. And you risk undermining your own credibility with people who don't understand how science works. So they're waiting until they can nail it down at all 16 corners before they go public with this stuff. But that's what they're thinking among themselves now. In which case, we have a very much more urgent problem than we thought. I should offer you one thought about this. Why does the IPCC get it wrong all the time, particularly given that the very same scientists whom I'm interviewing are very often people who sit, senior scientists, sitting on the IPCC's committees? And there are two reasons they offer me, and I think they're right. One is that all of the IPCC committees work by consensus. Now, anybody who has ever sat on a committee that works by consensus understands that the most conservative person present holds the whip hand. Because we can all agree that the problem's that big. Actually, most of us think it's this big or that big or that big, but we can all agree on that. That's the consensus position, the lowest common denominator, and that's what gets into the report. The other phenomenon is that the data in the IPCC reports is much older than you think. Now, 2007, the report's published. The committees actually met in 2006. So they imposed a deadline on further scientific published research after the end of 2005. They didn't want it coming in every week as they were trying to wade through the pile they already had. So nothing that was published after the end of 2005 got into the 2007 report. Now, how long does it take a scientific paper from being submitted to Science or Nature or Geophysical Letters or whatever to being published? And the answer is generally around 2 years. I mean, the whole peer review process, you know, the authors give it to the editor who sends it out for review to other scientists, generally the rivals and competitors of the authors. Back come the comments, the criticisms, passed back to the authors. They respond. You can go around this two or three iterations. It takes a year more often than not. Then, finally, we're all agreed, it goes in the queue for publication, which for serious publications is rarely less than a year long. So the papers were not written after the end of 2003. Now you have to ask yourself, how old is the data in the papers? They did their data series, and then they analyzed it, and then they wrote the paper. So the assumption that I think you're safe in making is that none or very little of the data that is underlies the 2007 report is more recent than 2002. So of course they come in low, and they've come in low every time. And it's moving a lot faster, and we do have a rather urgent problem, I would say an emergency, on our hands. That is the first conclusion. The second conclusion is that the generals are right. There are going to be lots of jobs for the military, even in a world 1 degree warmer than now, because the principal impact of warming in the early stages is on the food supply. And eating is a non-negotiable activity. You stop eating, your carbon footprint goes to zero quite quickly. So what they're looking at is scenarios, and you know how military people love to scenario monger, scenarios in which some countries are being hurt very badly in terms of their food supply by climate change, and others, mostly ones further away from the equator, are being hurt less badly or not at all. I mean, in the case of Canada, once again, you know, the lucky country. Poor old Australians used to think they were the lucky country. They are not. We are. They're the first victims of climate change, and we are going to get away almost scot-free. Even the States doesn't get away scot-free. The closer you are to the equator, the bigger the hit. And the hit strikes the food supply, and so that's where you get the waves of refugees from. They can't feed themselves at home. That's where you get the failed states from. The government can't feed the population, loses all credibility. And that's where you get the regional wars from. Upstream states grabbing the water, what's left, and downstream states starting to starve. Let's just look at a few of these scenarios and what they're doing. I'll start with a very gentle one. And this is the scenario that the Pentagon is doing about climate change in North America. Now, as I said, we get away almost scot-free. And the Americans themselves don't, but they can still go on eating at the end of it. They lose basically most agricultural production on the high plains west of the Mississippi by 20 or 30 years from now. It won't be raining there anymore, and by unfortunate coincidence, that's about the time they also will have pumped that big underground aquifer, the Ogallala Aquifer, dry, so they won't be irrigating either. And they probably lose the Central Valley of California, which is where they grow about a third of their fruit and veg, because that depends, it's a basically near desert, which is only fertile because of the irrigation from the Colorado River. And the Colorado River only has water in it in the summertime, when you want it, because of the snowpack in the mountains. It doesn't rain in Southern California in the summertime. It's a Mediterranean climate. But what happens is the snow falls in the mountains in the winter, melts in the summer, keeps the river full through the summer when people are trying to use it for irrigation. Now, the problem is, even 1 or 2 degrees hotter, and most of that snow doesn't fall anymore as snow. It falls as rain in the winter. It runs off right away, so the Colorado floods all winter and then is largely empty in the summer because there's no snowpack. So the Americans don't get away scot-free, but they're big enough, and I mean, they've got a huge amount of coastline, and it'll all be always be raining within a couple of 100 kilometers of the coast. So they'll probably go on eating, but they will probably not be exporting much food after all this has happened. And this is one of the big phenomena here, which is that the international grain market dries up. If enough countries get hit like that, and most of the big grain exporters are out of business, you can't buy your way out of trouble anymore by importing food. And trouble is what the Mexicans and the Central Americans are going to be in spades. Basically, every scenario I have seen depicts a future for Central America and Mexico in which they almost dry up and blow away. They're subtropical, very dry already. It gets a lot worse, and it will not support 200 million people down there anymore. So where do they go? And the answer is pretty obvious. They go north. They already go north if they have no work. And the Americans actually don't try very hard to stop them at the moment. You know, there's a pretty steady flow across the frontier, 3,000 kilometers long. In the cities along the border, it looks like the U.S. is really trying to stop illegal immigration. But go 10 kilometers outside the city in either direction along the frontier, and what you see is three strands of barbed wire and nobody watching them. Not because they couldn't close the frontier, but because they deliberately leave it porous since American farmers want lots of cheap, stoop labor. The Pentagon knows that the political demand to shut that border will become irresistible in the United States, and they'll be ordered to do the job. Now, they know how to do the job. Shutting borders isn't really that hard. You know, two words, iron curtain. We know how. I can tell you how to shut a border. It won't cost you much either. You put up a 3-meter-high razor wire fence, and you run a high voltage current through it. Behind that, you dig a ditch, a dry moat, 3 meters deep, 10 meters wide. Down there, you put your motion detectors. Then, at the other lip of the ditch, back behind, you put another 3-meter-high fence, and on that one, you put your video cameras and your searchlights and your remote-controlled machine guns. And you can also put mines down in the moat, if you want. And now that border's closed. That, by the way, those are the specs, precisely, for the border that Saudi Arabia is building along the frontier with Iraq at the moment, 900 kilometers of it. For America, 3,000 kilometers, so it would cost them almost 2 months' worth of the Iraq war, but no more, to close the Mexican border. And the only tricky bit is that even when you do all that, you have to be willing to kill people if you really want to close the border. Now, to the best of my knowledge, the U.S. Army has not got a blanket opposition to killing people. But they have thought this through. Okay, we're killing people at the border to protect America from an unstoppable, otherwise unstoppable wave of refugees who'd completely change the character of the country, but 1/4 of the American population, I'm talking 15 or 20 years down the road, 1/4 of the American population itself is of Mexican and Central American descent. It's 1/6 now, but it'll be 1/4 by then. How are they going to feel about us machine gunning their distant relatives along the border? Probably not all that positive. So what the Pentagon is actually looking at, and it illustrates how far they've gone in the thinking about this, is the worrisome question of whether in closing the border between the United States and Mexico, you are not laying the groundwork for the deepest and most worrisome division in the U.S. population that you've seen since the American Civil War. Let me hop to the other extreme. Let me tell you how to get a nuclear war out of 1.5 degrees of climate change. The great rivers of South and East Asia almost all arise in glaciers in the high Himalayas or the Tibetan plateau behind it. Rather like the Colorado River and the snowpack in the Sierra Nevada, those glaciers in the Tibetan plateau keep these rivers full in the summertime. It snows and their mass builds up in the winter, and then they melt in the summer at the front and keep those rivers topped up. We're talking about the Indus in Pakistan, the Ganges in India, Brahmaputra in India and Bangladesh, Salween in Burma, Mekong in Indochina, and indeed the Huang He, the great river of southern China, all of them growing out of glaciers, which are melting. Chinese Academy of Sciences figures, and they're mostly in China, these glaciers, they're losing their mass at 7% a year. So they're half gone in 10 years, almost entirely gone in 20. So there's the future in the parts of Asia fed by those rivers, and I do mean literally fed. You're talking about close to 2 billion people depend on irrigated land that is drawing water from these rivers. When the glaciers are gone, these rivers will be very low, half or less the amount of water they've got now in the summertime, which is a big problem for anybody who's irrigating a lot of land and feeding people with that production from Pakistan all the way around to China. But it hurts more some places than others. It hurts most in Pakistan, because Pakistan's basically a desert with a big river running through it. I mean, it's Egypt squared. It's the six tributaries of the Indus River coming off six glaciers up north in the Hindu Kush, joining together as the Indus River and then going to the sea, or rather not getting to the sea anymore. It doesn't reach the sea. They've taken all the water out. But that river and its tributaries supply the largest contiguous area of irrigated land on the planet. And it feeds about 150 million people. There's 175 million people in Pakistan, and you couldn't feed more than 25 million without that water. Now, the tricky bit is that five of the six tributaries flow across India before they reach Pakistan, through Kashmir and the northern Punjab. There's a deal, there's a treaty, it goes back 50 years for the division of the river waters between the two countries, and India actually takes a relatively modest share. And most of it goes through to Pakistan, which is only reasonable given how dependent Pakistan is on this water. The problem is that India's share is defined not as, 25%. It's defined as this much water, X cubic miles, kilometers, actually acre feet back in those days. So if the glaciers are gone, the river's flooded for 15 years and now it's half empty in the summertime, and the Indians take their share, and it's written there in black and white in the treaty, there's not much left for Pakistan. Would the Indians be saintly enough to just sort of cut their take? We'll do it on a pro rata basis, be nice to the Pakistanis? It would be nice to believe that India was run by saints at that point in their history, but it's probably not likely, especially because India will actually be suffering serious losses in food production too. I was in Delhi about a year ago, and I was interviewing the head of a think tank there called IRADEA, Institute for Research and Development, I think. And she said she just finished a contract for the World Bank in which she had been asked to figure out how much agricultural production India would lose at 2 degrees hotter. And she went back after doing the due diligence and told them that it would lose 25%. India just barely feeds itself. It's going to have more people than it does now in 20 years' time. It's going to lose maybe up to a quarter of its food production, not in 20 years, but in 30 or so. I kind of think they're not going to be very generous if they are entitled by treaty to take the full amount of water, the pound of flesh, that the treaty says they can take. In which case, Pakistan starts to starve. So why food? Why does food get hit first and worst? There's really three reasons in ascending order of importance. One is the general rule of thumb. In a warmer world, if it's already wet in this place, it gets wetter, and if it's already dry, it gets drier. Neither of which is good news for farmers. If you have enough rain, you don't actually want more. You'd like some sunshine, too, and you certainly don't want torrential downpours that wash your crops out. If you're farming on dry land, the last thing you want is less rain, so you lose both ways. Second reason, regional specific, but it covers a wide region. In the tropics, most of the major food crops are very near the top of their temperature tolerance range. Rice, for example, the major strains of rice grown in Asia will not tolerate a temperature of 32 degrees Celsius during a crucial 10-day period in their maturation. If it's over 32, they do not germinate. There's no grains of rice on these plants. Most of these countries are at 30 degrees already at that point in the year. There's not a lot of wiggle room here. The biggest reason of all is a thing called Hadley cells. It's a huge atmospheric circulation, biggest on the planet, actually, named after an Irish scientist called Hadley, who was actually trying to figure out what caused the trade winds a couple of years, centuries ago, when the trade winds were how you got across the oceans. It begins at the equator and near the equator, 1,000 kilometers north and south of the equator. Of course, it's very hot there, so there's very high evaporation both over sea and over land, and at the surface, therefore, hot, moist air, which, being hot, is continuously rising. Warm air rises. So the hot, wet air at the surface rises, cools. Being colder cannot contain the moisture anymore. That comes out as tropical downpours. And high above the equator, 7 or 8 kilometers up, top of the troposphere, just below the stratosphere, cold, dry air, always. Then, that cold, dry air, here's the equator of the warm air rising, cooling, cold, dry air above the equator, and it gets pushed away from the equator, north and south, by more warm, moist air coming up from below. Continuous cycle. Cold, dry air flowing north and south, coming back down to the surface, around 3,000 kilometers away from the equator. And as it comes back down to the surface level, the pressure rises, so it heats up. And it hits the ground as hot, dry air around 3,000 kilometers away from the equator. And that is what causes the world's deserts. I never knew that before. They didn't teach me that in geography. But the deserts are not scattered around the planet in attractively random arrays. They come in two belts about 3,000 kilometers away from the equator, caused by the circulation of the Hadley cells. After that, the circulation goes back towards the equator on the surface, and that's the trade winds, which interested Hadley. It's the deserts that interest us. A belt of desert in the northern hemisphere starts in the American Southwest, northern Mexico. You go straight east across the Atlantic, don't change your latitude, and you're in the Sahara Desert. Keep going east, you're in the Arabian Desert. Keep going east, and you're in the deserts of southern Pakistan and northwestern India. Same in the southern hemisphere, Atacama Desert, Chile and northern Chile and Peru. Straight east across the Atlantic, you're in the Kalahari, southern Africa. Keep going out over the Indian Ocean, and you are in the dead heart, the great central desert of Australia. Those deserts, caused by the circulation of the Hadley cells, will expand if the Hadley cells expand, which they do when it gets hotter. You put more energy into the system, more heat into the system, the Hadley cells expand. And the hot, dry air comes down over, guess what, the breadbaskets of the planet, where we grow most of the world's grain. The breadbaskets are only a little bit further away from the equator than the deserts. I mean, the Mediterranean basin, immediately north of the Sahara. North Indian plain, immediately north of Rajasthan and the deserts of northwestern India. The Australian wheatlands, the great inland empire, just south of the central desert of Australia. The great corn-growing region of southern Africa, likewise just below the Kalahari. And indeed the American Midwest, just a little bit further away from the equator than the deserts of the southwestern U.S. and northern Mexico. So if the Hadley cells expand, you start losing crop production big time. That's where you lose the agricultural surplus and the international grain market dries up. That's principally what happens there. And it's already happening. I mean, there's two forms of evidence for it. One is that by the rather arcane measurements that meteorologists use to determine where the subtropics end and the temperate zone begins, that boundary is actually moving away from the equator towards the pole and has moved 2.5 degrees of latitude, which is about 150 nautical miles, 250 kilometers, in the past 25 years. There's a much more direct form of evidence, which is the fate of Australia. Australia is the canary in the coal mine. It's the driest continent. It's where you'd expect any of these effects to appear first, and they are appearing. The Australians are now, I was there in September, and they're obsessed by this. The Australians are now in the seventh year of the worst drought since European settlement. So bad that they have banned irrigation throughout the interior of Australia, even though the crops are dying in the fields. What's left in the rivers in terms of water is being saved for the cities. Farm families going broke at $15,000 a month. And the Australians have begun to suspect, in fact, rather more than suspect, that this is not an ordinary drought. Droughts end. You know, eventually it starts raining again, normal service is resumed. But they are thinking this isn't a drought, this is climate change. In which case, this is the new normal, it's never going back. And in that case, Australia's out of the wheat export business entirely. That whole inland empire dries up. Western New South Wales, Northern Victoria, inland Western Australia. That's why, by the way, John Howard, the Australian Prime Minister for the previous 10 years, was thrown out of office in November of last year in the midst of the greatest boom Australia has ever seen. Everybody except the farmers making money like bandits, and they chucked him out because he's a climate change denier. George Bush's deputy sheriff in Asia, and they figured he'd let them down a bit since they're losing their farms and indeed losing that whole export income. But the implications are much larger for the customers. Australia will always have enough food for itself, like America, a lot of coastline, and in the case of Australia, only 20 million people. But they won't be exporting wheat. They're not doing it now. They were the second biggest exporter 10 years ago. They may never do it again. So food is the issue. And we are very close to the edge on food supply, even without climate change, more so than people realize. You must have we had a little bit of an alarm last year. There was just a couple of local crop failures. Nothing to do with climate change, so far as I know, the sort of thing that happens from time to time. But the price of almost every major grain doubled, if you recall. Wheat went up 2.5 times. Highest prices in 30, 40 years. Because the supply barely meets the demand now. In fact, it doesn't quite. We are the heirs of a miracle in the sense that the population of the world has more than tripled since the Second World War. 2 billion and 45, now it's 6.7 billion. And we're feeding them all, or almost all, and most of them are eating actually better than they did in 45. And we're doing it off the same land because we haven't actually made any more. Miracle of the loaves and fishes. The Green Revolution, you know the story, how we got all the new hybrid crops that were more higher yielding. Actually, that's a small part of the story. The rest of it's a lot less green. We threw gas and oil at it. We used 10 times as much fertilizer, made mostly from natural gas now, as the fertilizer we were putting on the land in 45. We're actually damaging the land. We're using so much. You're in diminishing returns deeply by now. You can't get more crop yield by putting more fertilizer on the land. And we're irrigating 3 times as much land as we did in 45. That's how we did the trick. Did they find a lot of new rivers after 45? No. They started drilling down for water. All that extra irrigated land, 2/3 of what we're now irrigating on the planet, is water being pumped up from underground aquifers. And those aquifers, some of them don't refill at all. They're fossil. When you pump them dry, it's over. Others do refill, but even those who are pumping at 3 or 4 times the rate they can refill. So this is a solution with a deadline on it. It runs out. But for the moment, you know, we are actually feeding the people, or almost. Grain production in the world went up 3% through the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, even the early 90s, every year. And then it's been flatlining for the last 10. Population goes on growing. There's another 2 billion coming before we level off. But for 10 years now, grain production hasn't increased globally. And the result is that we're already eating into the reserve. There is a figure people use, which is called the World Grain Reserve, and it's not all stored in one place, but it's an estimate of how much grain is left in the bins and the storage places just before the next big northern harvest. Most of the grain is grown in the northern hemisphere. Just before the next big northern summer harvest comes in. What's in the bins in August or July? That's the World Grain Reserve. 10 years ago, it was 150 days worth of eating for everybody on the planet. We are down now to 50. A large problem which will engender a great many jobs for the soldiers. The deeper we get into this, the harder it's going to be to make a global deal. I mean, we now inhabit a very favorable world for complicated global deals, like getting on top of our emissions and sharing out the pain and agreeing on targets, because no great power expects an attack from any other. We are at peace. The media struggle manfully to make us feel like we're living in permanent peril, but the world is a very peaceful, friendly place compared to almost any other period of history, which is a happy thing because we need to make this deal. The deeper we get into climate change, even 1-2 degrees, the harder that deal gets because countries are at each other's throats. Some governments don't even exist anymore. So there is a kind of timeline here that you have to observe. You really want to get this done quickly, not slowly. Third conclusion. There is a point of no return, and we're going to sail right through it. This is a personal judgment, though I hear it from many, many of the scientists I talk to. The point of no return is 2 degrees hotter, average global temperature. Because somewhere north of 2 degrees, but well before 3 degrees average global temperature, you trigger the big feedbacks and you lose control of the process. We are at the moment in control of what happens to the climate, in the sense that what has destabilized it and started the temperature going up is our own emissions, not just industry, of course, agriculture and forestry too, but it's our emissions superimposed on the natural cycle and the natural amount of carbon dioxide that would leave in the air, which is causing the warming. So if we cut our emissions, the problem goes away. I think you have to cut them completely in the end. We need to be completely out of carbon, fossil carbon fuels by 2050, but that's not hard. It's 42 years, we can do that. And 80% by 2030, leave the hard bits for last. But if we get beyond 2 degrees, then the feedbacks kick in. Somewhere around or a little bit above there, the feedbacks kick in, you lose control. Because natural processes take over that are dumping more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere than we are, and we can't stop them. And the feedbacks, there's three major ones. One we are triggering now, but happily it's the smallest of the three. One is what happens when the Arctic sea ice vanishes for a large part of the year. Because as long as that ocean, which is a big ocean, is covered with ice, it reflects most of the incoming sunlight back into space. It does not warm the planet. Take the ice off the ocean and you've got open water, dark and absorbent of sunlight, which it turns into heat. 90% of incoming sunlight is turned into heat. The Arctic Ocean becomes a heat engine, changing the heat balance of the entire planet. That's a feedback, because once that happens, you can't reverse it. The big ones are the permafrost, the melting of the permafrost, and the warming of the oceans, both of which will ultimately, if it proceeds, release enormous amounts of carbon dioxide. The oceans at the moment are a carbon dioxide sink. They absorb carbon dioxide. In fact, they absorb about a third of the excess carbon dioxide we produce every year. Right away, a third of it goes in the oceans, not around to drive the climate change. It's in the water. Not good for the oceans. In the water, it turns into carbonic acid. And carbonic acid's not good for living things. When I was a kid, my mother, who was a bit of a sadist, used to take a tooth. Whenever one of us kids lost a tooth, she'd take a string and she'd suspend it in a glass of Coca-Cola, which, of course, has carbonic acid in it. That's what the carbon dioxide in Coke is. And it would take about a week for this thing to be eaten away entirely by the acid. Well, it's doing the same thing to the shells of the tiny sea creatures who are at the base of the food chain in the oceans. And if they can't form their shells, they don't survive. And if they don't survive, the food chain collapses. So this is not doing the oceans any good, but it is actually, at least, postponing the evil day when we arrive at 2 degrees hotter. But the oceans are gradually warming. They warm very slowly because they turn over. You've got to warm the whole ocean from the top to the bottom, not just the surface layer. So it's a slow process, but it's happening. And at a certain point, and it's around 2 degrees hotter, they reckon, the oceans lose their ability to absorb any more carbon dioxide. You know, warm water can hold less dissolved gas than cold water. Warm beer goes flat, and so do warm oceans. First, they cease to absorb carbon dioxide, and all of what we dump in the atmosphere stays there. And then a little bit warmer than that, and they start to release carbon dioxide. They become a carbon dioxide source, not a sink. Once that happens, it's irreversible with human devices because we can't cool the oceans. Permafrost, same story with a few extra wrinkles. 950 billion tons of carbon dioxide locked up in the frozen ground around the Arctic Ocean and under it on the continental shelf. That's as much carbon dioxide as there is in the entire atmosphere, ours and the natural cycles. If it melts and that comes out, you give a huge kick to warming, and of course it's a feedback that then melts more carbon dioxide and so on. And there's methane gas as well, which is even more effective as a warming agent, much more effective than carbon dioxide, less of it, and it stays in the air less long, only about 20 years versus 2 centuries for carbon dioxide, but boy, is it effective. So, if we trigger these feedbacks, we lose control, and we are on an escalator that can take us up through 3 degrees, 4 degrees, 5 degrees, 6 degrees hotter. No way to get off. You can't refreeze the permafrost. So you got the disaster. European Union has an official policy. It must never get hotter than 2 degrees above the 1990 level, ever. Most scientists I know have that as their private policy as well. I think it will actually spread to the other industrial countries quite quickly now. Now that the American obstruction has been removed. This is really scary stuff. And by the way, when you push the scientists up against a wall and you ask them 3 times, they will admit they're not really sure 2 degrees is safe. The most they'll say is 2 degrees hotter gives us a 50% chance of not triggering the big feedbacks. Not a happy thought. The processes are beginning. I mean, obviously, it doesn't all go bang one day and then you get the feedbacks. Rather, it starts small and grows. It is starting small, but it's actually beginning to happen. The tropical oceans are losing their ability to absorb carbon dioxide. I've seen reports saying it's 30% down the last 5 years. And certainly, the permafrost is melting at the edges. I was talking to a fellow from Yellowknife. Well, he's native. He lives out in the land a couple of hundred kilometers from Yellowknife the other day. He'd been at one of these lectures, and he came up to me afterwards, and he said, you know, when we go out from the village in the summer, the melt ponds on the surface of the permafrost are bubbling. There's methane bubbling up through them, and you can take a match and light it and throw them on the pond, and the pond catches fire. Methane burns. Some of them will burn all summer. So a Russian research vessel sailed the whole length of the Arctic coast of Russia this summer past. Every time it went past one of the big rivers' mouths, Ob, Lena, Yenisei, all of them, it found there were columns of methane bubbling up from the seabed, the no longer frozen seabed, warmed by that fresh water coming out from those rivers. Bubbling up so fast, it's not even being absorbed by the water, it just hits the air as gas. So we must not go there, and yet, I'm afraid, we're going to. 2 degrees hotter in scientific talk is equivalent to 450 parts per million carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. We are already at 387, and it's going up 3 parts per million every year. So you do the math in your head, and you can see it. We're there in 20 or 25 years. Very hard to stop this supertanker and turn it around in that amount of time. The technologies are there to get out of fossil fuels. I mean, as far as generating electricity is concerned, we could get out in 20 years with very little trouble, because the alternative technologies for generating electricity, not burning coal, not burning gas, are on the shelf. They're market ready. The wind farms, the solar arrays, wind and tide takes a little bit more development. The nuclear is there. The hydro is there, though we've used up most of the good hydro sources. And then there's this new candidate, geothermal, which is really promising. Under our feet, 2 kilometers down, most of the land surface of the planet, there is hot rock, 200 degrees Celsius, twice the boiling point of water. You drill a hole down, 2K is not much of an effort these days, and you put high-pressure water down that hole. It filters through fractures in the rock. If the rock's not already fractured, put it under higher pressure and fracture the rock. And as that water filters through the rock, of course, it turns into steam at 200 degrees. So you drill another hole down a couple of 100 meters over, and it comes up the other hole as high-pressure steam. Clap a turbine on the top of that, you got power. They're actually doing full-scale trials on that kind of technology in New Zealand now. You don't need to be in a volcanic area anywhere, or practically anywhere, will do. We can replace coal and gas relatively easily. We turn over the entire generating capacity of this society every 40 years anyway. You know, the pipes are cracking, the design's obsolete, you could make more money if you tear that one down and put up another one. So all you have to do is do it about twice as fast, and don't replace it with fossil fuel burning sources of power, and you're home and dry. Bit tougher on replacing oil, because that is a high energy fuel that we can use in moving vehicles, cars and planes and ships and things like that. You know, to take an awful long extension cable to run all that stuff on electricity. The problem is not can we fix it, it's will we. And it's not for lack of will or lack of knowledge, it's just an immensely difficult deal to make. Everybody's got to be on board. No country is going to take on the cost of getting its carbon emissions down by 80% by 2030 if everybody else isn't doing it too, because it puts you at a horrendous competitive disadvantage, and there, you know, we still have to make a living. Which is why they're trying to negotiate this global deal where everybody gets on board and we all adopt the same targets. Kyoto was a botch. This time we need to get it right. The deal that kicks in 2012, if we get there on time, should be signed in 2010. I wouldn't hold my breath. Will last for 15 years. And that's when we get the emissions down, and we only get one kick at this problem, so get it right. The problem is, it's such an incredibly lopsided deal. Very hard to negotiate, very hard to sell back to the folks back home. The key problem is this. Almost all of the carbon dioxide of human origin that's in the atmosphere now, which is causing this crisis, comes from the old rich countries, us. North America, Europe, Japan, a couple of other places. China didn't put any of it up there. India, Brazil. You haven't seen them driving around on freeways in tens of millions of cars for the last 50 years. They might be starting now a bit, but the crisis is here, and it's our emissions. So historically, I know we didn't know what we were doing, but we're to blame. So you can't go out to China or India or Brazil or South Africa or Turkey and say, okay, what we're going to do is everybody's going to take 90% cuts. Fair? What you will get is a punch in the face. Because they know that's not fair. They're poor. They're still poor. And they're desperately trying to climb the same ladder we did into comfort and security and a little bit of fun. And what we're telling them is they've got to stay poor. Because they're never going to get the rest of the way up that ladder if we make them cut their relatively modest emissions, about a quarter per person as much as us, by 90%. So the deal has to be enormously lopsided. And if you talk to the negotiators, they all know what the deal will be in the end. It's quite often that way in international negotiations. They don't know when they'll get to it, but they know what it'll look like when they've done it. And the deal is this. The old industrial countries will take enormous cuts. They will cut by 90-95% in a very tight schedule, 30 years, and front-end load it, get two-thirds of it in the first third of the time. And the developing countries will agree to cap their emissions about where they are now, or let them grow another 10% and then promise to get them down by that 10% over the following decade, but they're not going to take deep cuts. And also, somehow, under that cap that we agree on now, they've got to be able to go on growing their economies. They're not going to be willing to stay poor. So any new power they put in had better be non-fossil fueled. And the problem is they're still poor, and the cheap and dirty solution is usually a coal-fired plant. So how do we persuade them to put in something else instead to keep on growing their economies under that cap? How do we persuade them to put in the nuclear plant, the wind farm, the solar array? And the answer is, we pay the difference between the cheap and dirty coal plant they can afford and what we want them to put in. Indeed, they in their own interest ought to be putting in, but they're too poor. That's the deal. Everybody knows it's going to be the deal when we get there, but they don't know when, because the problem, I mean, apart from the sheer lopsidedness of it, which makes it really hard to negotiate, how do you sell it to the folks back home? Imagine for a moment that I am Prime Minister Stephen Harper. It's a stretch, I know. And I've just signed the deal. It's finally been signed. It's probably not 2010. It's 2013. It took a while to get there, but better get it right than get it quick. And so now I've got to come home, and there's an election coming up, and here's my election platform. I promise that we Canadians will cut our emissions by 90% in 30 years. It's going to cost us a lot, but it's our duty not only to the world but to ourselves. We've got to stop this stuff. So your taxes are going up, I'm afraid, and Alberta has to shut down the tar sands. Good luck. And I also promise that we're going to ship about $50 billion Canadian out of this country every year to China and India and Brazil and South Africa and Turkey and so on, so they can go on growing their economies twice as fast as we grow ours without increasing their emissions. But they have promised to cap their emissions about where they are now. Vote for me. The thing is, that's got to be an election-winning speech, or you don't get the treaty. Until we're ready to accept that that's a reasonable proposition and vote for a government that does it, no government will do it, and the treaty won't happen. And that's why we're going to miss the deadline. We'll get there in the end. You know, it's true of the whole human race, not just of America. Churchill said it of Americans, but, you know, the whole human race. We always do the right thing in the end after we've exhausted all the alternatives. And we will, in the end. But I think sufficiently late that we will slide right through 450 parts per million, which is the equivalent of 2 degrees, probably hit 500. Most people think it's likely to be 550 before we get this corralled. And that means you've broken the barrier. You're triggering the feedbacks. You're on that damn escalator. Or are you? Because happily, there is a final conclusion, a fourth one. You can cheat. There's a way. It's called geoengineering.